My guest today on In the Arena is Lane Beachley. Lane is a seven-time world champion, and she speaks to each of these experiences of winning and success and her journey to those world championships in the most wonderful and insightful way. One of my favourite lines, which I draw from the sport of surfing, is the great saying from Jon Kabat-Zinn: we can't stop the waves, but we can learn how to surf. And I speak to this with the leaders who I have the opportunity of coaching. And accompanying that image is this picture of Lane, and she's in her element in this photo. She's sitting on a board, she's got a beautiful smile on her face, sun-kissed face. But her generosity, I believe, is the fact that she talks to her challenges and her struggle, both when in the water, but also when out of her element in many other facets of her life, like, you know, many athletes having to deal with, and the creation of an identity and a purpose beyond your sport. And she's done this wonderfully. This is a deeper conversation. She's someone who has clearly done the work, and both from the perspective of leadership, but I think mostly in regard to, you know, the various challenges that we're always going to have to contend with as, you know, we go through each of the phases of our existence. And she has a very storied life, and she continues to have a storied life, and she brings this beautiful generosity which comes from her vulnerability, you know, which comes across clearly in her authenticity. But as I like to say, there's no vulnerability without bravery, and this is a very brave conversation. So enjoy seven-time world champion Lane Beachley in the arena. Well, I'm here with Lane Beachley, and indeed an honour. And as LinkedIn now tells me, you're the Chief Awakening Officer. Is that that's
correct?
The title?
That is my title. Yes.
So I'm going to avoid it, but I'm going to say it. Other than seven-time world champion, yeah.
Just that little minor detail.
Yeah, but even in the context of that, and had a quick chat downstairs about this. There's 400 competitions that you were then a part of to create that outcome, and even ideas around sort of loss and losing, and the wisdom that actually brings you really comes out in the work you do now.
Thank you. Yeah, learning how to lose taught me how to win.
Yeah, yeah, and even then, it seems that another level within that is the teaching element of learning is a really strong theme for you as well.
It is, because I feel that one of our greatest opportunities as leaders or learners or successful athletes and coaches and leaders, that we can teach. I mean, we all teach what we need to learn anyway.
Yeah, that's a beautiful line though, isn't it? We teach what we need to learn.
Yes. Yeah. So there's sometimes when I'm standing on stage and I'll say something, I'm like, oh, I need to hear that today.
Yeah. Or sometimes you almost need to come back and listen to your own speech again and write notes on what
exactly
you spoke to.
Yeah. Or just read my own book.
Yes.
But what the beauty of success is taking the time to break it down into digestible chunks and then teach that to others. Mm. And then that ultimately shortcuts the struggle, and it helps people succeed at a faster rate. They're still going to endure their challenges and their setbacks, but perhaps we can shortcut the struggle and make it an easier journey or an easier experience.
Yeah, almost giving them the benefit of your bruising.
Yes, but knowing, I like that. Can I take that?
Yeah, I think I got that actually. And it was really quite a momentous time of life, actually. I was asked to speak at Alan Jeans, was a great football person, his funeral. But he actually invited the people before he died.
Oh, that's a good thing to do.
And so it meant that, you know, there was an inevitability, clearly, that, you know, he'd got to that stage of life. And I spent time with him, and I kept talking to ideas around leadership and wanting his insights. And I remember him said to me at one stage, he said, "Sonny, you said you want the benefit of the bruising without doing the bruising yourself," is what he said.
But
he
was Sonny.
Sonny. It was always Sonny. It was that way of
that's
it.
That's gold.
And, so the lessons and the idea around the teaching learning piece for you is at what point does that happen for you, that you realise you've transferred from learning for self as it relates to learning for others, even to become the best at what you did? You obviously would have had to have had at least a learner mindset through some phases of that.
Yeah.
Would that be fair?
100%. I mean, my learner mindset started very young. I mean, just And I'm a kinetic learner, and I love to watch and learn. And okay. So learning how to surf, I taught myself. Then traveling the tour, I had to figure it all out on my own. You know, I'm 17 years of age, and I say to Dad, I'm going to America next week. He's like, wow. Where are you staying? I don't know yet.
Yeah.
How are you going to get there? I'm not quite sure, but I'll figure it out. Yes. I became very street smart. I often say that traveling the world tour taught me more than any other educational institution could possibly teach me, because yes. I learned how to think very fast on my feet and adapt to a lot of change. That's also the nature of surfing.
The surfing, yeah.
Yeah.
Particularly you with a whole lot of... You were the only female out in the surf, as I've read, in those times.
Most
too.
Of the time.
Yeah.
Which was a challenge. But watching other surfers and seeing how they do it and then attempting to apply that is how I learnt my craft.
Yes.
And then watching how they compete and then recognising where the weaknesses or the flaws or the gaps were in my approach,
mm-hmm.
and then going up to that particular athlete and going, how do you do that? Can you teach me how?
Mm.
And I became extremely annoying. Because I was asking a lot of questions and my peers didn't want to give me the answers.
Yeah, because they were competitors.
Well, they were competitors, yeah. And back then in the 80s and 90s, women's surfing had a really toxic scarcity mentality.
Yes.
So we didn't share much. We didn't see much opportunity and we just dragged each other down a lot. So fortunately, they didn't actually see me as a threat because I wasn't technically sound and I wasn't very advanced in my approach.
Mm.
But I was an avid learner and I had the beginner's mind.
Did you notice as you started to emerge as a threat that there was less of
yes.
the preparedness to share?
100%. Yeah. And what was really interesting too is as I became more and more successful and had that dominant period throughout the 90s and 2000s, mm. my peers started asking me questions and I would be open and honest and candid with them. But because I was so dominant, they thought I was fucking with them. So they didn't take my responses as honest truth. They just thought I was trying to manipulate them.
So you were distracting them in some shape or form.
Yeah, but they were distracting themselves by preventing themselves from accepting the lessons that I was willing to share with them. I mean, they were asking me about their equipment because I knew more about my equipment than they did. I knew more about my fins and just all the technical advances that I was embracing and wrapping my head around because that gave me a competitive advantage over time. They would ask me questions about that and I would openly and honestly give it to them because, number one, okay, you're questioning your ability, so I've got you. And number two, I back myself, so I've got you. And number three, I'll let my surfing do the talking because I believe in myself and I believe in my ability.
Mm.
They just didn't think I was being honest with them.
Yeah, so that sort of generosity to teach was there for you at that stage.
Yeah.
Was there in... having to explain it to someone, is that where the penny dropped for you that you said, well, this is actually asking me to know it in order to explain it?
Yes. And you know what was really fascinating is that because I won 6 consecutive world titles, I was literally being asked the same question after each world title every year. And I got really bored with that. So I had to come up with different ways to answer the same questions to maintain...
your own energy.
Really. My own, own engagement, because I get bored. I'm a Gemini. Variety is the spice of life.
Yeah,
well, you get 2 for the price of 1.
I think you've actually captured all of that across a lifetime. So I think you're going okay from that perspective.
Mm.
Yeah, because I'm really interested in, because there is the individual sport and the potential selfishness of that coming from a team-based environment where if we can't, often joking, particularly in the men's game, I think it's different in the women's game, but from the men's game, we recruit the most selfish human beings known to mankind, the 18-year-old male.
Yes.
And then the very first thing we have to educate them in is selflessness. And that was those.
How does that go?
Well, if you can't make that transition, you can't
play the game. How do you coach selflessness?
Well, we coach selflessness for the same reason as what you spoke to before. Yes, there is a selfish pursuit to be the best you can be, but if there is not an underlying mindset to grow and learn, and ideas around belonging, I think, are a very, very big part of it, that you almost can't belong to this group, this team, unless you make that transition if we're serious about being good together.
Kind of like Legacy, James Kerr's book.
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
Don't be too big to do the small things.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And I think probably the reason why that book was so successful is I think it was the best articulation of that mindset. We do need you to be the best you can be, but we need you to be the best you can be within the context of know your role, accept your role, play your role. You know, if you're not prepared to know and understand what your role is, and then...
But who establishes that? Is it the playing group or is it the coach?
I think it's a great question. I think initially, it depends on stage and phase. So we often talk about it across three phases. I think initially, if it's a younger group and a new coach, a new person, I think it's really important that the leader at least does two things. Firstly, they come in with a clear sense of their own standards and their expectations, but they have to be able to meet the group where the group's at as well. You can't have...
With a young group, do they really know where they're at?
A lot of the time, but there's generally not... They're not all young. Okay. So that's the second part of it, that you need to get...
You can't have an entire green team.
No, you can't. Yeah. No. You need to have the more influential voices in the group being prepared to embrace, you know, the standards and those expectations. If you miss that... the chances are it's not going to work it's going to take longer. And that's okay because it can. And there's not a lot of patience in elite sport, as we know, in that sense. So,
and they have to model the behaviour that they want to see in others.
Yeah, definitely. And that group becomes very important because the coach isn't at any point – they're not spending a lot of time with the group. You know, that's, as we know, with you would have spent a lot of time with your coaches, would you, because you travelled?
Well, I was fortunate that my boyfriend became my coach.
Yeah.
And I think I was one of the few athletes in my generation that actually had a coach. Mm. Most of us did it on our own. We weren't earning a tremendous amount of money either. You know, I spent 19 years on tour and earned $500,000 in prize money. Yeah, so it's not like I was rolling in it. But my coach was my boyfriend, my shaper, my mentor, my sounding board.
Yeah. And so shaper in a literal and a metaphoric sense in that sense, probably.
Yes,
so it was 100%. your board shaper.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So, and how, because you said you weren't technically strong in the sport because it was self-taught.
Mm-hmm.
How did you go with the prospect of getting worse before you got better?
My desire to win far outweighed my fear of failure.
Okay.
So that's what helped me maintain the focus on, okay, I'll do whatever it takes to improve. If that means letting go of everything I know and starting again, I'm willing to do that because I'm sick of coming second.
Yes, I see.
I'm tired of coming runner-up to the world title. That doesn't inspire me. That actually depresses me a little bit. Like, so I just needed to get out of my own way and focus on where my fundamental flaws were and then start building on them.
So there was a bigger thing going on for you, which meant that you were comfortable with the fact that you might be finishing second, but you might finish 10th in order to finish first.
I never even considered that.
Did you?
Really? No. Yeah. I went from second back to third and then came back to second.
So you weren't as technically as bad as what you
might. I was pretty bad.
Were you?
I mean,
really?
Look, surfing is all about getting to your feet and doing it swiftly, smoothly and fast, and I did not do any of that. It was a 3-point turn. It was a real gradual process. And then I surfed as I said to my coach when I first met him, not my boyfriend at the time, one before that, my surf coach Steve, I said to him, I've been told I surf like a crab.
Mm.
And he goes, what does a crab surf like? I said, I'll come up and show you, because he lived up at Brunswick Heads and I lived down in Sydney, and I went up there and I surfed two waves, and he called me in. He goes, I have good news and I have bad news. Good news is I want to help you. Bad news is you surf like a crab.
Right. So you agreed with your definition agreed with the popular view of you as an athlete.
Yeah.
So that bigger thing which was actually driving you, and without, you know, I don't want to, I'm only going to paraphrase back the words I've heard, is the first five through fear, the second two through love.
Five in fear and one and seven in love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the one and seven world titles were my bookends.
Were they?
My loved base world titles.
Oh, so that it started with the love.
It did. Well, it started, years one to seven were just fear. I was a victim. It was everyone else's fault.
Right.
When things didn't go to plan, either the conditions or my board or my peers or the judges, like everyone else was getting it wrong.
So blame
and shame. And then I realised the common denominator to all of that was me, and something needed to change, and that had to start with me. Then I fell in love with process. I fell in love with Ken. I fell in love with improving and challenging myself and growing myself. So I started to be the change I wanted to see without waiting for external validation to determine whether I was doing it right or wrong, because it's only judgment that determines whether you're doing it right or wrong.
Yeah.
I jumped out of judgment and fell in love. And just following the process of being a better human being a better competitor, being more knowledgeable about my equipment, taking more ownership and accountability for how I approached my career – less drinking, less partying, more sleep, better nutrition, just the simple things, as we know, those one percenters made all the difference. Then I won that first world title after 7 years of being a classic victim. And then all of a sudden now I'm successful. I'm placing immense amount of pressure on my shoulders to be deserving of doing it again.
Right. And that's where the fear kicked in?
That's where the fear kicked in. Yeah. It's amazing how when you achieve something great, all of a sudden you think, oh, no, what do I have to do to be deserving of doing this again?
Yeah, where did the fear come from? Is it from there, from that sort of feeling comparison. Of undeserving? Yeah.
Comparison came. That's
the
where
thief,
it came
the
from.
The thief of joy, they talk about
exactly,
it.
Exactly, 100%, yeah. And the thing was is that Lisa Anderson was a 4 times consecutive world champion from America. She was the golden girl of women's surfing.
Yeah.
And when she lost to me and I won my first world title, she actually retired halfway through the year injured, and the American press stated that I won due to her absence.
Okay.
And that stabbed me in the heart a little bit because they were diminishing my results, they were diminishing my effort, the commitment and everything that I'd committed to doing to achieving that goal.
Mm.
So now I felt instead of improving myself, I'm now proving myself. And once you go from proving yourself, or once you go from improving to proving, you're now in comparison and fear and judgment.
Mm.
And when you're living through that lens or performing through that lens, it's fueled by ego, which is why I hurt my knees in the first year.
Yeah.
Because knees represent ego.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So talk me through that.
Well, the body holistically represents different aspects of our lives. So the shoulders, if you've got shoulder problems, you're carrying the weight of the world on your shoulders.
Yeah.
If you've always got digestion issues, there's something in your life that you're not digesting.
Yeah.
Your hands, you're always gripping. There's something you're not willing to let go of. So with my knees or hips are moving forward, knees are ego.
Yeah.
And in the second year, 1999, after winning my first world title, I tore my medial ligament in my right knee. Right knee, masculine side, left knee. Wow. Female side.
I'm getting some lessons here.
Yeah.
I remember Jimmy Steins.
You can read some Louise Hay.
Right, okay.
You can heal your life. Well. That's where you'll learn a lot of this stuff.
No, I'm really interested in that because I remember Jim Steins used to always say, and I mentioned just before that I've had prostate cancer, and he says that, you know, women feel in heart, men in gut, you know, and sort of downstairs, upstairs almost mindset.
Yeah.
And I hadn't thought about that for a long time until I got diagnosed. And I wondered, because it's... Yeah, the types of pressure and stress that we put ourselves under, and that's a version of it that you're talking to there, that you're, whether it's a stress response to the fear element or a stress response to... And it's interesting because another little thought came to mind. Then Nick Maxwell, in his podcast, talked about he spent first part of his career proving people wrong and then the second part of his career proving people right.
Yes, a toxic way to play.
Yeah, it was. And he was more in the second part was just to, you know, he wanted to play with gratitude for the people who trusted him, say, with captaincy and these sorts of, almost the care, you know, that they believed in him at a level perhaps that he hadn't quite believed in himself.
And how did that, from a coach's point of view, how do you think that impacted the way he played?
He played a lot better when he played.
But did he still play his best?
Yeah,
was
I think
he consistent?
So. Well, he'd be the best one to judge that.
Yeah, let's go get him.
From the outside looking in, and it's interesting because there's actually Patrick Cripps, who won the Brownlow medal this year, talked about him changing from in that similar sort of mindset in some ways.
Yeah.
Where there was a freedom which came with it in the end that he... The second year of, I think, well, it might have been the first year, Nick made All-Australian for the first time as captain when he felt that he wanted to play from gratitude rather than anger, if you like, in that way. And and those ideas around what motivates and drives at a really personal level.
Mm.
So it seems like
most athletes don't really connect with that.
No, did you at the time? That was what I was going to ask you. So at what point does a torn medial ligament, you're not necessarily thinking, was it medial? I think you said, that are you thinking at that point in time that is something to do with that, or is that a reflection now?
Yeah, it's a reflection now. Yeah, there's no way I'm thinking, okay, masculine side, right knee, ego. I reflect on it and go, I was showing off. I was trying to prove to myself or someone that I can do this particular manoeuvre, and, of course, it was in the smallest of waves.
Right, so you made other judgments were being...
Oh, there's plenty of judgments and... Yeah, concerns. Yeah. But I think, all of this reflection and introspection occurred after winning my 6th consecutive world title. And someone asked me, are you enough yet? Actually, I've achieved my goal. And then what do you think's driving you? Do you believe it's because you're adopted? And that shattered my heart. So there was so much truth in it. So I accepted that and went, actually, you're right, that's what's driving me. I'm not driven through love, I'm driven through fear. So when I hear stories around athletes trying to driving themselves through proving something, I often say stop proving and just start improving.
So that concern with my comment around proving, say Nick, you know, proving right, proving, the word proving was probably the key trigger word for you in that sense.
Absolutely. I was proving something. I was always trying to prove something.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was a young kid, I was trying to prove to the boys that I deserved to be in the water. And then I was trying to prove to my critics and naysayers that I could win.
Mm.
And then when I won, I just felt an immense amount of satisfaction. And my peers, I think, were as satisfied for me as I was for myself because they were sick of hearing me talk about it.
Yeah.
So when I won, they're like, thank God, you'll shut up about it now. But then I went on to desiring a whole lot more than just one.
Yeah, that the connection between sort of achievement and worth.
Mm.
You speak about that in that. So one of the things I picked up from your book almost immediately, that idea of your worth was very much related to your sense of achievement.
Yeah, so when we talk about being a 7-time world champion, 5-1 in a state of fear, 2-1 in a state of love, 1 and 7 were my love-based world titles. My self-worth was not wrapped up in how I performed or whether I won a world title or not. My self-worth was actually not defined by anything outside of me. It was all intrinsically motivated and I was intrinsically connected with who I wanted to be and how I wanted to show up and held myself accountable to achieve that or had honesty barometers in my life that held me accountable. And there's very few people that have earned the right to share in our pain and there's very few people who have earned the right to be in our dream team.
Yes.
So focusing on who those people are because they hold you accountable but bring the best out in you.
Yeah.
I was very fortunate that I've had people in my life that I've been able to find and hold very closely. But when I won my first one, then I went into the self. I lost myself in the winning.
Yes.
And I decided that my self-worth was now defined by whether I won or lost. So the way I like to explain it, it's kind of like this little wave. If I'm not winning, I'm learning. And that's the love-based mentality because I'm playing with surfing and competing and living with a sense of gratitude and ease and grace and trust and love. So I'm winning, I'm learning, I'm winning, I'm learning. Because as we know, nothing always goes the way we plan or very little.
Yeah.
So just adapting and adjusting and trusting are really important elements to follow through life.
So trusting self.
Trusting self, trusting intuition.
Yeah.
But if we're all always in here, we're never listening to here. We're all here. So our gut and our heart, which are our strongest communicators of intuition, get silenced by the noise between our 6 inches between our ears. But world titles number 2 and 6 were fear-based, which means that when I'm not winning, I'm losing.
Yes.
I'm not winning, I'm losing. And that's when I knew my self-worth was wrapped up in how I performed and the results that I produced. So at the end of the day, when I reflect on winning 6 consecutive world titles, I wasn't going for 6 consecutive world titles. I was literally going for self-worth.
Mm.
I was going for love. That's all I was striving for, but I didn't realize that at the time.
Which is really binary sort of way of thinking about yourself, isn't it?
Like yeah.
When really the way you described the love was almost nuanced. It's connecting with, you know, it's interesting, people talk to intuition. I spoke to John Bertrand about this idea, and he's got some really interesting takes on it. He says you're basically just connecting to your wisdom. He's how he would say it.
Mm-hmm.
That you have had whatever experiences you've had in your life to this point, of which you're now accessing in those moments, which is a much more nuanced, you know, if it's love-based, for instance, whereas if you're judging yourself in a binary way, and a little thought came to mind when I was, you know, reading through your stuff, is this, you know, no one else knows, you know, what shit you're going through type mindset is how you speak to that.
Yes.
But there were times where I found myself almost speaking out loud about, I think I'm fucking this whole thing up. You know, those sorts of ideas. And, and it was actually my wife who straightened me up and said, I don't want to ever hear you say that again. And it wasn't, for her, it was, mate, you're not.
So you started saying that just when you're in the car without it?
Yeah, pretty much. I started saying it myself.
In the coaching room?
I was, the Get Smart Cone of Silence. Or something like that, so no one else gets to hear it.
Yeah.
But it's clearly not serving me well because all I'm doing is joining some external chorus of blame because there's always, you know, blame is a place which sport goes to really quickly.
Especially when you're energy depleted.
Yeah, and you find it, and that's interesting because it was those times.
Find your triggers.
Yeah, and it is, And it often needs people around you to say your energy is depleted here, yeah, because you've gone there in a really slow way.
You
don't land there, you know, it's not like you've trained hard, yeah, I'm tired.
It's the frog in the boiling water mentality. It's that syndrome where things just start happening slowly and then all of a sudden you find yourself in a really negative dark spiral and wondering, how the hell did I get here?
Yeah.
But so, I know my triggers. I know if I'm in a – well, I know my behaviours if I'm in that state. So if I'm comparing myself to others or if I'm criticising myself, so I go from self-doubt to self-loathing, or I'm craving foods and things that I know don't support my health and well-being. In fact, they sabotage it in the long run. I know I'm depleted.
Then
that often leads to states of anxiety, depression, retreating, silencing.
Yeah. You had great avoiding. Fatigue as well, didn't you?
I had it twice. Bouts. Yeah, I didn't learn from it the first time.
No, is that right?
No.
Yeah.
No, I just saw it as something that, okay, I'll just get through that and then carry on. And then the second time was horrendous.
So it sounded like you spent a fair bit of time trying to outwork your problems initially.
100%. Yeah. Every problem that occurred, mentally, physically, emotionally, I just saw that as another challenge I had to overcome.
Yeah.
And the more my body broke down, the harder I worked.
Yeah.
But the body whispers before it screams.
Yeah, that's a beautiful line.
I did not listen to the whispering.
Yeah.
I do now.
What about the brain? Does it whisper before it screams?
The brain whispers before it screams, 100%. Yeah. And the brain is, it's a pretty remarkable vessel. It's a powerful force.
Well, you've seen the best and worst of your brain.
I have. I certainly have. Yeah. I've seen the darkness and the light.
Yeah. So in terms of actually, clearly there's an awareness which recognises that you may be heading to darkness. How important is, I think, I can't remember exactly the term you used in terms of your support group. There was a lovely
dream team.
Your dream team, yep. So how important is your dream team to your... to your to where your brain's at any
imperative time. So my business partner, my husband, and a couple of my best friends, they're almost they're almost psychic in their ability to read me, because they're always paying attention. So I'm very fortunate that I have people in my life that care about me that much, that they're paying attention to my behaviors and understanding, or at least recognizing if they've shifted or changed in any way. I am a silent sufferer. Because I grew up in a childhood that was tough love. So it was okay to make mistakes, but it wasn't okay to be injured or damaged in any way. So don't show that you're tired, hurt, pain.
No. A few repressed memories have just bounced back.
Yeah, I know. I just saw you go, oh,
Just for the benefit, I did fold my arms in that moment. Yeah.
So because I had that tough love, silence pain, I am a silent sufferer. Which prolongs my pain and suffering, because learning to honour our emotions, no matter what end of the spectrum they're at, is what helps us process them and move past them.
Mm.
Our basic emotions only last 90 seconds,
but quick,
the stories we wrap around them last a lifetime. Yeah. So we've got to be conscious of those stories, and that's the nature of the brain. So there was a time very recently where I was in a depressed state because I was future thinking, which is one of my triggers.
Mm.
And future thinking always leads to increased levels of anxiety.
Mm.
And I have tendencies to get anxious. And then if I don't address that and I keep silencing it, and as Brené Brown says, you know, if you put shame and blame and guilt into a Petri dish and cover it in darkness and secrecy and leave it there, then it explodes.
Mm.
But if you take the same Petri dish and shine a light on it, it dies very quickly. But I was closing it up and covering it in secrecy and silence and shame. And then one afternoon my husband said, are you okay? And I finally got to that restless state within myself where I went, no, I'm in a funk. I don't know what to do. I don't know how to feel. I have the toolkit and none of it's working. I'm meditating, gratitude journaling, immersing myself in nature, doing things I love, hanging out with people I love. I've got all the tools and none of them are working. And I started crying. He goes, do you need a hug? I said, yes, that's all I need. I just need you to hold the space for me right now. And that turned me around because I finally acknowledged to myself that I wasn't okay. I shone a light on it and I shared my pain with someone who'd earned the right to process it with me.
Yeah,
so it was really beneficial. And so all the men out there, if you've got mates that are struggling, give them a hug.
Yeah, and that is powerful. And the thing which, again, comes to mind is this, you used the word honour before. Yeah. So you're honouring your dream team in that.
I'm honouring myself first and then I'm honouring my dream team.
Yeah, you're giving them – because if you don't acknowledge in that moment that they're seeing something in you that you haven't quite seen in yourself, perhaps.
Yes.
And they, you just maybe...
You deflect, deny, avoid.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can't help anyone that's not willing to help themselves.
No, so yeah, so that's the honouring.
That's the honouring.
It's just not picking the team and putting it down on a piece of paper. You've now, it's the, with that comes a sense of responsibility. 100%, that if, yeah. if you've asked them to call it out and you don't then acknowledge it. And the interesting thing is it's in the, if anyone out there is picking their dream team now, and it'll only be tested when you are going shit house. You know, like it's actually, that's the time you go, yeah, this is what I want to do, but guess what I'm going to do when I am going shit house? I'm going to actually ignore every insight that you have and you're giving me in this moment.
Exactly.
Well, you won't have your dream team for very long.
No, you won't. But it'll also be tested when you're at the top of your game too. Are they still there? Are they still celebrating you?
Right, that's interesting.
Yeah, because your dream team elevate and celebrate and they're happy for your success.
Yeah.
But then you'll find the dream thieves who have a scarcity mentality and don't want to see you succeed because it says more about them than it does about you.
Is it possible, I don't know if you've seen it, but there's the Colin Hay documentary on Netflix.
No, I have to watch it. What's it called?
Yeah, I think it might just be Colin Hay, yeah. Cool. And it was done in 2015 and... Because he's playing, at one stage, they're almost the biggest band in the world, and you'd be very
Which
familiar
band was
with
this.
It was the Men at Work type environment. They just become so big so quick.
Yep.
And then he tells his story that he's playing in Broome, and he's basically on the road with just him and his roadie almost at this point. And he's almost like a troubadour, you know, just him and his guitar and plays. And they're playing in Broome, and the guy comes in and he says, Colin, there's no one here. Like, there's no one here to listen to you play. And, you know, 5 years earlier he's playing in Men at Work in whatever. And he's really – it's quite beautiful the way that he talks to it. But is there a thing that your heights were so high that there's always going to be part of you which will struggle in moments because of how lofty it became for you? Like
I feel that that's produced by an addiction to the ego.
Yeah.
You know, because if you allow yourself to get swept up in the highs, then you will ultimately end up somewhere very low.
You would have been swept up though, wouldn't you?
Look, there was definitely times I was swept up, but I also knew it was finite.
Did you really?
Yeah, so I enjoyed it while it was happening. The biggest mistake that I made throughout my career is I didn't celebrate my successes.
Okay.
So I embraced humility a whole lot more, contrary to popular belief, if you ask my peers. But
is that because they weren't seeing that part of you?
Yeah.
But inside you were...
Well, inside I wasn't worthy, which is why I drove myself so hard. Yeah. Which is
why
that
the same as humility?
No.
Yeah.
No, but I was attempting to deflect my lack of worthiness through humility.
Okay.
But
I see. So you're basically presenting yourself to the world in as a humble person, but it was actually the humility that might have been covering up something else.
Insecurity.
In that moment. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So I think about the heights of success. I loved winning, but I'm actually an extroverted introvert. Mm. So I really loved getting away from that.
Mm.
And I loved just being in a place where I could just be not recognised and not celebrated and just have my own space and time to regenerate my soul.
Mm.
And fortunately I still get to do that every day in the surf until someone paddles up and goes, hey.
Yeah, there would be a bit of that.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
Yeah.
But, I think about when I had my states of depression in my professional surfing career, it had nothing to do with the highs and lows of competition. Mm. And a lot of us believe success has to be hard. And because we're self-fulfilling prophecies, we'll continue to find ways to prove ourselves right because we'd rather be right than happy.
Yeah.
So if I'm going to continuously believe success has to be hard, then I will look for ways to prove that that's the case. And I'll actually make it harder than it needs to be.
Mm.
That's why the roller coaster existed, because I wasn't being true to myself. Mm. I was worrying about what other people were thinking. I was attempting to fulfill a whole lot of stealth expectations. I was lacking boundaries around my energy and time. Mm. I had really poor decision-making framework. So then I started sabotaging myself, which ultimately led to destructive behaviours and poor results. And then I wondered why I was in the depths of despair again, because I just wasn't being true to who I am.
And finding the wisdom from that, how much did anxiety and depression teach you in regard to your personal wisdom now?
A lot. Yeah, it taught me a lot about acknowledging how I feel, like owning my feelings and being okay with not being okay, which I feel everyone could learn from. Yeah. What's not okay is that we stay stuck there and we silence it and suppress it and deflect it and deny it and pretend, oh, it's all good, which is one of the biggest bullshit statements in the world. It's all good. It's not all fucking good all the time. No. Life is not all good. Life is challenging.
Yeah.
We need to learn to embrace that. But depression in my competitive career and the anxiety taught me two things. Firstly, honouring my emotions. Secondly, having the courage to ask for help. Because we all believe we have to get there on our own. Well, I certainly did.
Yeah.
I'm like, you're not with me. Get the fuck out of my way. I got this. I'm on a mission.
Was the courage to ask for help out of some form of desperation?
Yes.
That, yeah. That you've just run out. You've run out of options here.
Yeah. Well, I found myself in states of suicidality.
Yeah.
So that was scared the shit out of me. So, I'm like, okay.
So you're top of your sport and you're in a
state. Yeah. So you don't actually have to have a mental illness or a mental injury to have poor mental health.
No.
You just have to acknowledge how you're feeling and then identify, well, am I in a good place? Am I not in a great place? What's leading to this? What choices am I making? Because as we know, it's the decisions that we make, not the conditions of our life, that determines the quality of our lives. And if we're making really bad decisions and expecting better conditions, then there's something a little bit off there.
Yeah.
Something's not aligned.
And did the want, because this image that I show of you, I then use the John Kabat-Zinn wonderful quote.
Oh, yes. Which one? So many of them from John.
No, it is. You know, we can't stop the waves, but we can learn how to surf.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's this beautiful image of you and, you know, the idea of learning to surf, and because the waves will still keep coming for you, won't they? You're not someone who's, you know, not offering yourself to the world, and you're offering yourself to the world in a way which is going to ask a lot of you at different times. So you're going to be asked to tell not just the beautiful story, but you're going to talk of your path from struggle to wisdom, really.
Yes, willingly, openly, absolutely, because it helps people feel less alone in their struggles. If it can happen to me, it can happen to anyone.
Yeah.
And maybe they'll find aspects of their story or their struggles within me, and perhaps able to put words around something they haven't been able to explain to themselves.
Mm.
So it helps people feel less alone, less isolated. I'm happy to talk about my stories. But as you've read in the book, I won't take anyone anywhere where I haven't been myself.
Yeah,
I've done the work and I'm willing to keep doing the work. Yeah. I aim to serve. Yeah. I aim to shine a light. I don't aim to tell or preach. I'm a helper, not a healer. But that's because I'm still helping myself grow and know myself better. And through those lessons, I'm able to share those experiences with to help people do the same.
Yeah, there's an important little definition and little line you've drawn in all of that, that you're a helper, not a healer.
Yeah.
Yeah. That somewhere along the line, the healing, you have to do, you know, it's, you know, the
got to feel it to heal it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so you got more of these bloody little signs than I have. I can wheel out a good one from time to time. But you know, because one of the reasons I tell the story is
which story
about this idea of can't stop the waves and the image of you is the fact that you're prepared to go to. Everyone says, you know, I want to be an authentic leader. So that's the thing. Okay, well. It's like people coming up to you and say, can I be honest with you?
Yeah.
You know, like,
so you haven't been for the rest of my life.
You've been talking shit all this time.
Trust me.
So that, I want to be an authentic. And so ideas around authenticity, because we understand what that actually means, because it's our best opportunity of creating connection if we're seeing some version of you. But it's actually to have your world to be a real expression of who you are. And my sense is that's something you've worked really hard to create.
Yes.
Is, I said that, what Lane offers us now in her world is a preparedness to cross a bridge, and the bridge she crosses is vulnerability. But then I say there's no vulnerability without bravery. Mm-hmm. And so the vulnerability in itself is almost how we experience you. And I'm sure in your own way you do put boundaries around your vulnerability in that sense. People don't need to know everything.
No, they certainly don't.
You know, we still
have a lot of things you don't need to know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it's actually working out which part. And so even for, say, leaders who listen to this, it's okay to put, I say, look, big paddock, strong fences. You know, so there's, and every so often the fence might move a little bit, you know, as you become more open about, You know, and I talked, you know, when we were coming in, I said, look, when I got diagnosed with depression, I remember thinking, how do I keep this secret? I get diagnosed with cancer. I think, who do I need to tell?
Mm.
You know, that still was there for me in mm-hmm. that sense. Mm. And so how, I'm sure, particularly in a very public life, in all aspects, you know, particularly when you make a call to marry a rock star. So that's actually, that adds another dimension.
Sure
again,
does, yeah, you know. 100%.
Yeah, so where do those boundaries start and finish for you?
Well, it made me reflect on, even when I was in my fear-based mentality, that I was, as I was tagged as having that compassion of a tiger shark, I was really focused on just winning and winning and winning. You still got the authentic version of me. It was just a fear-based authenticity.
Yeah, so it was still a version of who you were.
Still
at
a version
time.
Of who I was, or a version of who I believed I had to be.
Yeah.
To achieve what I was after.
Yeah.
Had I known what I was after, I know I would have done it differently. You know, I'm always asked, do you think you would have won 6 consecutive world titles without that kind of drive? And I can honestly say, yeah, because I've proved it to myself. 1 in 7.
Yeah.
I can win in love, and it's effortless and it's joyful. It's not without its challenges and setbacks and obstacles, but it's still way more fun and way less pain.
Mm.
So I had to learn to trust in that, but I chose not to. Because I believed that to become successful and to become worthy of love and to become the most successful surfer in history, I had to be ferocious and fearless and brutal, not only to myself but to others. And we can't give what we don't have. So I lacked empathy for myself, so I couldn't give – I can't extend that to anyone else. So you got that version of me, and that's who I believed I had to be. Today, the version that you get of me is not someone that truly cares too much about what people think of me. If I did, I would not be on social media, for example.
No.
I would not be sharing the content that I share. And, of course, the validation is so uplifting at times, and sometimes I love it. And then, of course, there's going to be criticism and, you know, people having a go. But that says more about them than it does about me. At the end of the day, if I'm copying ridicule or pushback or insults from my dream team, which are the top 5 people in your life, you become the sum of the top 5. If I'm encountering challenge from either of them, then I know there's something that needs to change. But if it comes from someone I've never known and will never speak to, then they're entitled to their opinion and I'm entitled to disagree with it.
Yeah, and you're entitled to totally ignore it as well.
I'm entitled to ignore it, which is most of the time.
That is, and I think if you, because you come from the mindset of the helper not healer, I really love that
that
line.
You can use
that. I will, because I think really that's what, because even in the work I do now, it never starts. I help leaders lead really in many ways. It's very much teacher coaching based.
Mm-hmm.
Is you always say that it's about leadership is what we're talking about, but ultimately it's about, you know, if it's not happening in you, it won't happen through you. So we don't talk.
I told you, I like that.
And it is one where if you, I don't ever talk to it as a personal development program, but clearly it's got to be almost to actually, and so even, and the power of what you bring is you're telling your own story here, and
I'm not telling anyone else's story, but my own.
And you still work, and it sounds like it's a work in progress always anyway.
Always.
So it's not. The story that you told 5 years ago, you know, will have evolved from when you were competing to the person you are now and the experiences that you actually have. And because that, as the wisdom grows, the intuition you access changes and it moves with it.
It sure does. Does that change the way in which you lead leaders?
Yeah, no, I think
it
does.
Or do you keep relying on the old tools? Because the thing that I find, it's good that you're always evolving and changing because I think as mentors and teachers and coaches and leaders, the biggest mistake that we can make is that we just stay stuck in what we know.
Mm.
And then we lack empathy because now we're just trying to prove ourselves right by delivering everything that's comfortable and everything that's known, and that becomes our truth and that becomes our Bible per se. And then we stop being empathetic because we stop seeing the world from the people, through the eyes of the people we're trying to help.
Yeah, we can't connect with them.
No, we can't.
And almost the core element of leadership, and I don't teach anything I haven't fucked up, so the one of the elements of it, and it sounds that for you too, really, in so many ways.
Yeah. Well, no, I do. I teach some things I haven't fucked up.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, I think my lessons come from fucking it up. So
that's because you believe success has to be hard, so we'll just stick with that.
Probably, but I think it is.
I don't learn unless I fuck it up.
I didn't mean to. I didn't want it. This thing wasn't about therapy.
Yeah.
That wasn't the intent here. Seriously. Now, let me make my point.
That you've learned that you haven't fucked up.
No, definitely has. But I think mostly the... You know, one of the things I often talk to is just the simple idea that the world's giving us feedback all the time.
Yeah, you know, are you listening?
Yeah, so it's not... So if I'm going to... If we were sitting here and saying, well, someone says, I'd like to be coached, and you actually do like one-to-one coaching yourself?
Not much, no.
It's mainly group-based stuff. And yeah,
I used to.
Yeah. So if it was that, it would be – the first question I ask is, are you up for change? Because it's kind
of – And what you're willing to let go of.
Yeah. So, and therefore, then the next question is, well, the change needs to be informed by something.
Mm.
And the thing that it's most likely to be informed by is some form of feedback. And it might be feedback from your dream team.
Yes.
It might be feedback because I'm reading your book and I'm thinking, gee, this is good. You know, this is great. And I think it's on our book list now for our CEOs.
Because it's
so practical. That's the goal. That's what it is.
Mm.
Parenting, for instance, is always giving you feedback, and you thought that was actually going to stop once they were sort of out of, but it's a different form of feedback.
There's some parents that don't want to see the feedback.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah,
because kids hold up a mirror to you.
Yeah, definitely.
And there's aspects of yourself that you don't want to see.
You're
like, hey, that's not me. and point a finger and I lay the blame.
And that's actually, it was a parenting challenge, which was the Brené Brown stuff, which led me to your stuff. It's that funny little pathway that we actually take at different times. Is beautiful line from Brené Brown at a time when I did have a time of change from a parenting point of view.
Mm.
We build the child for the path, not the path for the child. That sort of mindset, like you know.
Yeah.
And so these are ideas around feedback. And then the next question is, okay, the change feedback, now are you up for some sort of action? What are the one or two things we can do to create a sense of progress? Because I think motivation is very much reliant on progress, even if it's small progress.
Yes.
And then some sort of form of responsibility, accountability, whatever you want to say at the end.
Mm-hmm. Great formula.
Yeah, so it's just a really simple way of it. But the key one is that idea of feedback. And people think feedback is, someone telling you something.
Yeah, yes.
But it's not. If you carry two boxes down a set of stairs and you fall down when someone asked you whether you wanted help and you said no, you know, because we don't like being helped, you know.
So what led to that behaviour or what led to that choice at that moment in time? Because that triggers a story just last week where I was having a disagreement with my husband and so I just decided to pick up two boxes and walk it into the garage, and, of course, my knuckle scraped the wooden door and I ended up with a splinter in my thumb, my finger, which now is still quite sore.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, why did I choose to do that?
Yeah.
It's just because I was trying to prove to him that I could do it without him.
No, the world's just giving you some feedback.
There's always feedback. Yeah. Are you listening?
Yeah. So that is part of it. And I think there was a sense that, I don't know when you were growing up, but I just thought that people who were over the age of 35 or whatever it stopped. That was not going to happen anymore for them.
How old were you when you were thinking that?
No, I've never stopped thinking. I've always had a pile of books next to me.
Oh, right.
Whatever. I've always been up for these conversations, and I often wonder where it came from. And I know both of my parents were, and my father died relatively young, but my mum is always a learner. She's always reading. She's always open to whatever conversations that we're having. She's very up to date with the world.
It was role modelled.
Yeah, she was, yeah. And I think my brother and sister are the same. So there's a nature-nurture thing going on in regard to that.
So what about people who haven't had that role modelling?
Yeah, well, if they need to work it out for themselves in this sense. So what you take to the world, what you bring to the world as, you know, not to try to be the healer, because I think our first instinct is, I'm going to save you from yourself a little bit.
Yeah, I'm going to fix you. I'm going to rescue you.
So it reminds me, I remember... We got this rescue dog, Chops, and he sadly passed away this year.
So I'm still in
mourning on Chops. But when we're walking around just the tan one day, and he won't walk with us. He's just like, it's day one, got the new dog, and he's just doing everything you don't want your dog to do in that first instance. And my wife said to me, why are you always rescuing things? She said, why are you always...
Very good question, wifey.
It is a good question, yeah.
Did you have an answer to it?
I didn't at the time and probably still don't, would be.
Because there's the way that I see it, if you're rescuing, there's an aspect of yourself that you believe needs rescuing.
Yeah, I'm up for that.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm up for that.
And, I mean, if you believe that you have to fix or rescue something, it's coming from a mindset that you believe something's broken.
Yeah. There's also a little challenge inside it I loved as well. Like the footy clubs, for instance, I became CEO of were... Mm. they were really at their struggle phase when they and that wasn't necessarily by design. It was also they were the ones looking for CEOs.
Yeah. And you just said yes.
Yeah, and I was walking past the door, you know. So
yeah, and it comes down to how you make decisions too, right? So you would have read in my book, I have that decision making framework, in the early years of retirement, I really struggled to say no to anyone or anything. Actually, my manager gave me a trucker hat that has no written on it. You're depleting yourself. You're giving too much away of yourself. You're trying to help everyone and heal everyone, and you're reserving the most depleted version of yourself for the people that love you, and the most energetic and vibrant version for the people who don't even know you.
Yeah, no.
That's not okay.
No.
So you have to start making decisions.
The world just gave you feedback in the form of
Illness,
dream team. Yeah, I call it my five-person tent. Who's in your tent?
Yeah.
You know,
tent.
Yeah.
Right. We're that's a small tent. I hope it's a big tent.
No. For those who's in your dream team.
Yeah, so I know. I'm just being literal.
Yeah, no. We give
TP? Can it be a TP?
Yeah, we've got a little bloody, what was those ones you call, Belinda, now? You've got the, what's your tent?
Glamping.
Glamping. No, the one. Camper trailer. So it's giving you a little bit more.
I call it a cave. Man cave.
Yeah.
Who's in your man cave?
We have a man cave. But I've got some women in my man cave.
Oh, good. Yeah. Good. Just because it's called a man cave doesn't mean it's just restricted to men. No, there's an unconscious bias for you.
It was. Just a cave. I'm still really interested in this, the little fear to love transition you made.
Sure.
Yeah. Because if there's however many people listening to this podcast now, particularly leaders, you know, and I've had that little joke with you before. You've never led unless you've woken up the morning. Your first thought's fuck, which is normally we're fearing something which might happen, and we're probably questioning our own capacity to deal with that thing which might happen. So there's probably a little bit of a gap in there.
Yeah.
So the work you've done to and continue to do, and the generosity you now bring to the world, which happily to do so in a place which might actually bring judgment, you know, from people who don't know you.
Yes, that's okay.
Yeah, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a little bit more about that transition. How did it get from fear to love?
Well, I spoke about it earlier, around that first 7 years, right, where I was just ego-driven. Right. And then won the first world title in that state of love.
Yeah.
What I haven't really expressed on this interview is that the transition between coming second in the world to winning emanated from doing a rebirthing, which is essentially lying on the ground and going into a cyclical breathing exercise. It essentially sounds like you're hyperventilating, but it's equal inhale as it is exhale. So it sounds like... And what that does is allow the body to transmute energy that you're not okay with.
Mm.
I don't like to think about it. I'm not a psychologist. I don't work with psychologists or psychiatrists. I like to emotionally feel it and then release it.
Mm.
And that's the quickest and most efficient way for me to do that.
Yeah.
I went into that process. I woke up on the first time after doing it. And I say I woke up because I must have fallen asleep. But I became so aware of the fear that I was being driven by. And when I came out to, I was inconsolable. I was sobbing and just felt like this scared little four-year-old girl. And the realization was I had a massive fear of rejection from being told I was adopted as an eight-year-old.
Yeah.
The story I'd wrapped around that was that I'm worthless, I'm undeserving of love, and I must win to be worthy of love.
Mm.
Once I became aware that the fear was driving me, not love was driving me, I became aware of it so much so that it was no longer governing my choices. The fear doesn't disappear. It's just the story or connection that you have to it subsides.
Yes, I love that.
So I stopped focusing, because as you know, what we focus on expands. I stopped focusing on the fear, and then I fell in love with the process of improving myself. That's why I always say stop proving, start improving.
Yeah.
Proving is fear, ego. Improving is love, joy, grace, gratitude. So I fell in love with process, and that's when I won. Now all of a sudden I've put this expectation on myself to be deserving of doing it again, to prove to the American media that I was deserving of this win.
Mm.
And I'm going to prove to you, I'm going to show you, to prove to the guys at Manly that I'm not a one-hit wonder, to prove to my peers that I'm way better than you, to prove. I'm just constantly now improving. So now I'm in a relentless pursuit of success, but at what cost? So, as you said earlier, no one sees the shit you go through. They just see the outcome and think it was easy. It was not easy. In fact, those five world titles from world title 2 to 6 were some of the most painful, arduous, suffering moments of my life. But I still won,
yeah,
because I had that win at all cost mentality. Then my body broke down. And after winning my sixth consecutive, I had adrenal fatigue and exhaustion. But I'm like, let's do this again. Let's keep going. Mm. And then a neck injury that I suffered in 2001 flared up when I got an MRI. And it showed that I had 80% of my spinal cord severed from an injury that I suffered back 5 years ago.
Wow.
And chose to ignore it.
Yeah.
Just the body was screaming, but I was not listening because I must win, must win.
Yeah.
So the difference between love and fear is what you referred to earlier is feedback. And are you listening? Are you tuning in or are you tuning out? And as we know, if you don't go within, you will always go without. And I was all out here. All the external circumstances were like, okay, I've got this. I can do this. You're in my way. You're with me. All right, we've got this. Mm. Let's ignore the pain. Let's ignore all the heartache. Let's ignore the things that are going wrong. That's okay. Let's just keep focusing on our strengths and just keep pushing through, push through, push through. I have to reflect on that and go, I can't relate to that person anymore. Now, I know when I'm in a state of suffering or struggle, it's because I've stopped trusting and I've started trying and I'm pushing shit uphill and I'm not listening.
Yeah.
And that leads to pain, suffering, discomfort, heartache, struggle. And that's okay because it's feedback. Now it's time to stop and reassess and change course.
Yeah.
Mm. But if we're ignoring all of those pieces of feedback in this relentless pursuit of success and achievement and goal orientation, then we have to ask ourselves, at what cost?
Mm.
What is it costing me? Is my relationship with my loved ones strong?
Mm.
Is my relationship with myself sound? Am I healthy? Am I happy?
Mm.
They're the basic fundamentals, because otherwise we're just pouring from an empty cup and now we're looking for reinforcement to validate our choices.
You use that term beautifully in your book, and I'll let you go. Is your cup being filled? Just that simple idea. And it's interesting, Debbie Lee, who's become the sort of the person who really women's football and Australian football really was built around her courage in some ways.
Mm.
She talked about that in her podcast, that her cup now feels full, but it didn't when she was striving during that period of time.
Yeah, mine neither.
Yeah.
So today, for me to authentically inspire and empower people to live their best lives, I have to do that for myself first, which means going surfing, meditating, making the time for things that light me up. Mm. I take a week off every month to spend with my husband, to do things that are joyful, to detach from work. Mm. I work for myself. I can do that.
Yes.
I have to give myself permission to bring more play and fun into my life.
Yeah, and that's actually the interesting part, isn't it, when you do work for yourself, is giving yourself that permission. I'm still to learn that lesson. Thanks very much, Lane, mate. It's just been wonderful. I've been really looking forward to today. It's actually my birthday today.
What?
So I turned 61 today.
Happy birthday.
So this is...
Where's the cake?
We knew that we were actually having today, and it's also my wedding anniversary today.
Oh, happy anniversary.
And it was also my late father's birthday today. So,
oh, my God, it's all so about there's you all today, going, isn't
it? It is about the Schwabs today. So I had to mention that because... as soon as we got the date into the 4th, we were saying we were going to have a little celebration after having the great Lane Beachley with us today, with my crew here, and it's just been a wonderful experience.
Well, happy birthday to you, and happy celebration to your dream team, and thank you so much for having me. And we all know that success can't be built on that which has not been celebrated, so I trust you'll find a wonderful way to celebrate this milestone.
No, we will, and you're the milestone.
Oh, so, I was going to say, no, I'm not the milestone.
Thanks very much. It's just been wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers.